Welcome to the Productivity Show by Asian Efficiency, helping you do more and be better. And now here's your host, Zachary Sexton.
You are tuned into the Productivity Show by Asian Efficiency. My name is Zachary Sexton, and today I have with me Jay Papazan. Welcome, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's an honor to have you on. For a little background, you are an author who develops books specifically with business, real estate, and investing. And today we are going to talk about one of your more popular books, The One Thing, which you co-authored with your real estate mogul friend, Gary Keller.
That's right. It's probably of the 12 books we've worked on, it's been the one that's had the biggest impact in both my personal and my professional life. So I'm super excited to talk about it.
Well, I'm excited to dive in. This is a book I first heard on audiobook, and then when I found out we were going to come on together with this interview, I got the real book, and I'm so glad I did. There's so much in it. There's all these little drawings, and you underline. I really haven't seen too many other books that are written the way yours is written. But I guess my first question would be, how did The One Thing, the book and the philosophy, come about?
You know, it was one of those happy accidents. For a book about being purposeful, you know, it's a strange thing to say, but gosh, you'd have to go back almost 6 years now, maybe seven, and I was working with Gary on a course for real estate agents about how to lead generate better, and the course was solid. We felt good about it, but he wanted to write an introduction for it, and he took it home over the weekend, and he came back with an essay called The Power of One. And I remember reading that, and I got chill bumps. And as someone who'd worked at HarperCollins, I'd been in publishing and been privileged to work on some pretty big books. I was like, wow, you know, here's Gary Keller, one of the best entrepreneurs in my industry and possibly a lot of industries. And this is his one thing. I didn't say it that way then, but now I would say it that way. Like, this is his one thing. It's really smart, but it's not about his intelligence. He works hard, but it's not about how hard he works. The thing that's distinguished him as an entrepreneur, how he built the number one real estate firm in the world from one office, is this idea that he can identify the top priority and he'll give it more time and energy and focus than anyone else. So it felt perfect to me. And that was kind of where we all just said, this is a book. And we spent about 5 years researching and writing it.
Wow, 5 years. That is a big development time for what seems to be such a simple concept. There is a focusing question that's really at the heart of your book. Can you start to talk about that? Because I think a lot of people out there would be like, well, how do you spend a disproportionate amount of time on, you know, what should that be? And the question really gets to what every individual's one thing is, whether it be for that day, for that week, for that month, for that year, for the life. Building up this question, but can you talk about that for a little while?
It's a pretty humble when you see it. A lot of people go, really? That's one of the reasons it's kind of in the middle of the book, because we felt like we had to earn readers' trust before we unveiled it. But gosh, the focusing question, if you were just going to write it down, would be, what's the one thing I can do such that by doing it, everything else would be easier or unnecessary? And it's very purposefully phrased, even though it comes out of a story that I'll share with you. But it's, what's the one thing, not two or three? It forces you to really put all your eggs in one basket. I can do, not everybody wants to say, what could I do? What should I do? What would I do? And I always remind people of the Shel Silverstein poem, you know, all the woulda, coulda, shouldas ran away and hid from one little did. I want to ask the question and know what right now is in my arsenal of actions, such that by doing it means that it's not something that you get cause, effect, and there's just one effect. Everything else will be easier. Unnecessary is about the scale. Like, it's what's the biggest lever right now in your arsenal, you know, in the vein of the 80-20 principle, like what's my 20%, but really on steroids, that will give me the most of my result that I want. So it's about looking for the biggest leverage point in your life.
Do you ask yourself that question every single morning when you wake up?
More or less, it's become kind of my short frame. You know, the way I structure my days, my weeks, my months, my years. And, you know, it's funny, we were doing this as a company, and then we kind of because we were building the book, we got very, very particular about the language we used around it and built our tools. But pretty much every day, I'm going to walk into the office and I've got my goal sheet. And it's broken down. What are my annual goals? Based on those, every month I set my monthly goals. Like, where would I need to be at the end of this month to be on track for my annual? And then I have at the bottom of the page my weekly goals. What do I have to accomplish this week to be on track for my month, which will make me on track for my year? Like, you're working down, like, how do you eat the elephant one bite at a time? You're just working backwards from a big goal. Well, every day I ask the question, well, what's the one thing I can do today, right, to move that forward, to feel like I'm on track for my week? And I try to start my day with that thing. And I've been writing and researching and publishing and promoting books really for almost 2 decades now. And so it's less a question that I have to ask the answer every day in terms of the big activity and more about what specifically am I doing today? Because my one thing, obviously, is researching and writing books. Those are the things that propel our company. If we make a great product, people will read it and share it and spread it.
So your one thing in your work life is writing. Another thing that was in the book that really caught my attention was a quote from another book, a James Patterson book, that said, I don't remember the exact way it was, but if you're juggling, life is like juggling five balls. You've got work, family, health, friends, and integrity. All five of those balls, except for one, are made of glass. So if you drop any one of them, they'll smudge. You can pick them up. They might crack. So if you drop the family one, you might have a chip on it that you'll never recover from. But work, the work one is made of rubber, and that occasionally that you can drop it. Do you have your one thing in mind for family and for health and for friends? And do you do that same sort of year, month, week, day sort of backwards planning for it? Or is this more of a work-related thing where you look at that daily?
One, I love that you pulled out the James Patterson quote almost perfectly from memory. It was very impactful when we found it, and I just want to thank him publicly because he gave it to us for free. Most publishers would have charged us a bundle for that. But that was in the concept about the idea of work-life balance kind of being a lie. And you have to consciously, we call it counterbalancing, how you switch between the two. And that quote kind of captured the essence of, it's okay to be out of balance at work. We believe that if you're doing your one thing, there's a lot of fires that you're leaving unattended. And we think that's okay. In our research, the best businesses, the most effective people focus on their one thing, sometimes to the detriment of lesser things. And they make their peace with that because that's how they got so good at what they do. But you can't treat the other areas of your life that way. If you ignore your health, right? You work too long of hours. We read one research article that said that people who just work 55 hours a week, I think are 65% more likely to suffer from heart disease. And that doesn't even seem like a long time in this day of entrepreneurs who work from home pretty much around the clock. You can't ignore your health for too long, right? You need to constantly be going back and doing something regularly to feed it. You can't ignore your family, your relationship. So I thought that quote really kind of hit a big idea for us. When we talk about giving outsized attention to your one thing professionally, it's okay to be out of balance there. But in the rest of your world, you're not. And so I would say on page 114 of the book, which there's 7 circles that we identified, and I believe if you ask the focusing question all the time, you'll drive yourself a little crazy. Like, I don't ask what's the one thing I can do to fold these clothes such that by doing it, right? That's just a chore I do. It's not important. That's not where I make my money. But I think you should ask it about your spiritual life, your physical health, your personal life, which is something a lot of entrepreneurs, especially working moms, really abandon at different points in their life, much to their own detriment. Key relationships, your job, your business, and your finances. And I know people who've added their own passions. They're really into model airplanes, and that's got to have its own question. And that's cool. But I think that you figure out what are the big important things, and then you ask that question, and hopefully, our hopes for the book is that people then will time block some sort of habitual action around maintaining those things.
Maintaining the work-related things or all the other personal, the work, family, health, friends?
Over time, over 5 years now, I've kind of built out a calendar. Like my one thing for my health, like where I'm kind of making my stand, is 3 times a week we have a trainer that shows up at our door and we work out for an hour, my wife and I. We chose that we wanted to pursue our health goals together. We have small kids. I didn't want to get a babysitter so we could go to the gym together. I didn't want to miss time with my family. So we just said, well, let's just start waking up really early. It wasn't pleasant. In the beginning, it was at 5 a.m. until we figured out we could actually move it to 5:30 and still get the kids to school on time. But that one decision, that habit, makes us eat better. We go to bed earlier. There's just a lot of things that are good that have come out of that habitual action. And we asked and answered the question in those other areas much the same way. I think I'm on this show because for my business, I just asked the question, you know, I have my job and that's where I try to put 4 hours a day into my writing and research. But I own, I think, 11 different businesses I have ownership in or I am the owner of. And I had to ask the question, what's the one thing I can do, you know, that would help all of those things, that I can have the biggest possible impact instead of having 7 jobs or 10 jobs? How could I have 1 job? And I decided that the number one thing I could do that would help all of them was to build a really powerful network of people. And I got very purposeful about that. Now, pretty much every Wednesday, you're going to find me in a very particular coffee shop. We were talking about this before the show. And I'm going to be meeting with someone that I'm going to call talent with a capital T. And at this point, it's now 3 years into that journey. Sometimes it's 3 days a week. And I have no agenda other than I'm trying to make a relationship with someone who I've been told is talent. And hopefully over time, when I'm in need of talent, like if someone's leaving our company and I want to fill that with a quality person, my favorite people to hire are people that are referred to me. And now I've got a powerful network of people. I think talent hangs with talent. They're going to know someone. Well, so-and-so just left his job at IBM or so-and-so just left his job at Google. Have you thought about them? Like, no, I don't know them. Introduce me. And I think 4 of the last 5 open positions I've had in my businesses, we filled through that networking.
Jeff Woods, it's going to be episode number 42 of the Productivity Show, was on, and he was actually the one who connected me to you, and he's the same thing. He's all about forming those mentor relationships around you so you can get to the next level. In your case, you're at that higher level, but you're looking for people to bring on into your team. Also, we were talking before the show that you live in Austin, Texas, and I'm moving there pretty soon with my girlfriend, and we're really excited about it. The main reason we're moving there is because of the people. We wanted to surround ourselves with this entrepreneurial type environment that Austin has. So I think that's really cool that you have found different ways that you can block out time that will That's that first falling domino is an analogy that you use often in the book. In fact, the book, when you take the cover off, it made me laugh, is a domino.
Yeah, it's one of our Easter eggs in there. That's the metaphor for your listeners that don't know the book. When we talk about the one thing, the biggest lever in your life, right? We talk about a domino run. Like if you line up dominoes properly, knock over one and a bunch fall down. And so a lot of times I'll say, like, what's the longest domino run in your life? How can you line them up so that you can, with one thing, you can knock over a lot? And that's kind of the mental game you play. And for me, that was networking. If I networked properly and purposefully, I could be really doing a great thing for all those businesses. So I love that you're coming to Austin because now we can meet for breakfast.
There we go. And I'll have to go to your blocked out time, to your blocked out cafe, figure out where it is. Well, now that I know the time and the place, actually, I could just always go to that cafe and just over-listen. Oh, like, oh, who's this person?
There you go. Jay's talking to. Just join in. Become a mastermind instead
exactly.
of a one-on-one.
There you go. Can you dive a little deeper into a balanced life is a lie? This is underlined in your book. It's something that I feel like I believe too, but can you give us some more reasons why the work-life balance that's so popular in media today is just probably not true?
We've been kind of sold down the river on this one. It's an incredibly modern convention to talk about work-life balance. It actually shows up in LexisNexis searches of magazines and books and articles. It doesn't even appear on the scene until like the mid-80s. So when we talk to some social scientists about this idea, you know, obviously, you know, a serf in the medieval times didn't worry about this, right? They just had their life to live. Now we worry about how this all plays out. She explained to us that, basically in the 70s, women entered the workforce en masse. So you used to have a breadwinner and you used to have a homemaker. And suddenly you have two breadwinners and who got the extra job? And for almost a decade, it was pretty squarely thrown at the women. Like, great, you can have a career as long as you're home by five to put dinner on the table. And the first decade was pretty much women complaining about a lack of work-life balance. And over the next decade, it kind of, maybe men grew up and took on more chores. I would like to hope we did. But it became a, kind of a rallying cry for everyone. People felt out of balance. And we saw a real connection in the early 2000s, like when the BlackBerry shows up and then the iPhone, as the barriers between our work and our life went away, right? Now I can get email anytime. I remember a time where I had to go back into my home office, fire up a modem before I fired up a computer to get on my work email. Like it took 10 minutes to get into work at home. Now it's just your pocket buzzes or whatever and you're at work. And the number of instances that this phrase shows up really is leapt off the charts. And here's the thing. Work-life balance has been sold as a destination. If you can get your life just perfectly organized, you're going to feel balanced all the time. And it's just completely false. In our research, I mean, there's quote after quote after quote I could throw at you. It's a verb. It's not something you arrive at. It's something you have to do on an ongoing basis. I usually, when I'm speaking, I tell people, I want everybody to stand on one foot, right? Now, are you balanced or are you balancing? And everybody obviously says, I'm balancing. Great. That's what we want you to achieve. So you have to consciously do this. It's not someplace you get where it just happens. And I think that's the distinction we're most trying to make.
That's good. I really kind of see the point here where you're talking about it's never going to be something that you have to stop doing. You're not going to find this nirvana. The other day I was watching somebody tweeted a video at me on can you have the perfect day? And they had 17 minutes of meditation and 16 minutes of for shopping or all these different numbers. And the guy went through the day and at the end they interviewed him. He's like, man, I was stressful. That was not my perfect day. Kind of reminded me of that.
You know, I think over time, if you really pay attention to people who are, I mean, really successful, you're going to find that their days, especially their mornings, are highly ritualized. And that was one of my big personal takeaways from the book. I recently read a stat that high net worth individuals on average get up 3 hours before they have to go to work. And I immediately said, that's significant. Because when I talk to millionaires and multimillionaires, they're getting up at 5 a.m. because they're going to get their personal reading in. They're going to exercise. They're going to eat a healthy breakfast. They might even have family time blocked out then. Maybe journaling, meditation. That stuff all happens before 8 a.m. And they've just made it a ritual. They don't have to think about it. That's one of the big concepts of our book is if you figure out you're the one thing in these areas, if you make it a habit, and our research shows that on average it takes 66 days, not 21 or 30, 66 days of repetition to kind of on average form a habit in an activity, then that kind of becomes automatic for you. It's not work anymore. I can't imagine that guy trying to live the perfect day because all of those behaviors were new and required his focus and attention to do. But if you looked at someone who's been kind of living their life for a long time, you know, they're kind of walking in you know, automatic pilot through their first few hours because they've been programmed to do certain things. I want to be purposeful about those hours. Instead of getting on Facebook and Twitter, I want to be reading a great book. I'm going to be exercising with my wife. I'm going to have a healthy breakfast with my kids. You know, I've been trying to find little slivers in that time to build those habits over time.
It's almost like you went through our course on rituals. Those are the exact things that we teach people how to implement into life is wake up earlier, meditate, journal, all of those things through just breaking it down and adding one at a time, too. You don't want to overwhelm yourself with too much too quickly. And it was actually part of my morning ritual was working out, but then I found I actually liked doing it in the afternoon because I could get some focused work in. I would do my most important task. I would eat my frogs. Then usually I'd slow down. I would eat lunch and I'd feel a little foggy. So I was like, oh, if I work out, then I've got a great half to the second day. Because I was preparing for the interview together, I was like, ah, well, I'll just skip my afternoon workout. But then that's why I remember so clearly the James Patterson quote, because I was going over that and I had 5 minutes to get to my gym and I chose to go to my gym instead of over preparing for this interview. It's like, all right, that I can't let that ball drop and get a little crack in it. Work can always bounce back.
I'm glad you made that decision. I mean, I think one of my takeaways from the book is that if it's really important for you, do it in the morning, because we tend to have more willpower to do what we don't want to do. But that lull that you're describing is very real, and it shows up in some of our research too, is that's a place where we tend to be a little aimless on average. So if you can go into the gym, if your life allows you to do that, awesome. I just think that most people out there can't break away from 2 to 4 or 2 to 3 or whenever that is to work out. Some people can do it over lunch. Some people can do it after work, or you can do it before work. And so I'm just kind of talking about ballpark averages. But if you've developed a habit then, there's actually some research that suggests that's one of the most efficient times to work out in terms of building muscle.
Hey, watch out, ladies.
You're going to have some guns, right?
Yep. Well, I want to respect your time. And before we get to the end, I wanted to ask you one more question.
Sure.
About the one thing. you were saying you work, your morning is focused on one thing, which is likely either researching or writing, because a disproportionate of your results come from that one activity. Because of that, you'll want to spend a disproportionate amount of time on that. I'm pretty sure I'm just pulling this straight from your book. I'm looking at my show notes right now.
Uh-huh.
How much time should you spend on your one thing, and how do you get to that point where you can spend that much time on it?
You know, by the end of writing The One Thing together, Gary and I were blocking 6 hours a day. And he's the chairman of the board of the largest real estate company in the world and owns dozens of other businesses. So it wasn't easy, but we built up to it. So I usually tell people, if you could spend, you know, from 8 to 12 every day on your one thing, awesome. For me, I do, you know, about 9 or 10 is my start time, and I try to put in 4 hours with a small break for lunch. But I had to build up to it. That's the reality. If your one thing, your one activity gives you the vast majority of your results, that's the target to aspire for. The moment I tell someone 2 hours, they're going to do one. If I told you one, you do 30 minutes. So I'm going to tell you 4 hours, and the people who are killing it will get there. And have you heard of the 10,000 hour rule?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you did 4 hours a day on a regular work week, right, 5 days a week, it would take you 10 years to become a master at something. So if you're putting in less time than that, you're just extending that mastery time and putting it farther and farther out in your life. And that's something I aspire for. So people push back on that. I just say, well, let's just go revisit the front of the book. This is a surprisingly simple truth behind extraordinary results. If people want less than extraordinary, if they want average, you can put in a lot less time. So I usually coach people, why don't you start with 30 minutes? Why don't you start with an hour? And if you can get through a couple of weeks, then start adding on 30 minutes at a time. And build your way up to 4 hours a day. Because that's a pretty radical transformation in most people's days, and it requires a lot of discipline. Like, I've gotten really good at being efficient with my email, at monitoring my social media and getting out. And I had to get good at those things to maximize that time.
I lied. I've got one more question.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And this one is a little bit more personal, because since I've been reading your book and another one out there called Essentialism, I've really
Great
been
book.
Trying to hone in on where I'm best leveraged for
right.
Asian efficiency. And I feel like the one thing that I really enjoy doing is to teach. I like to find more focus and clarity by reading books and talking to people like yourself, and I like to help others do the same thing. However, I feel like there's a handful of different areas where I'm struggling. Which one should I spend the most time at? And since you have been there, maybe you can help me out, because
yeah.
I do online presentations. I host this podcast. I do coaching calls with clients. I'm not sure where I should be focusing my energy. I also write for the blog. So is my one thing writing? Is my one thing presenting? Is my one thing hosting? Is it public speaking? Is it working one-on-one with people? I'm not sure.
Well, I think if you looked at, imagine your business 10 years from now, and it's a $50 million a year business, those activities might all look like divisions in your business. And you probably would have someone who was in charge and rewarded for running each of them. Right now, as I'm guessing, you have a, it sounds like you have a freelance editor, and then there's just you. Or do you have more employees?
There is currently 6 people on the Asian Efficiency team.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I would be looking and asking the question, you know, if I could only do one of those things, where would my time be best employed? Doesn't mean you have to go straight there, but I would be trying to align those as much as possible. I find that I can be a teacher through writing. I can be a teacher at a keynote speech. I can be a teacher through being interviewed on these podcasts or delivering them, right? I can kind of exercise that muscle in different mediums. So I find there's a lot of commonality in the things that you just described, but if you want to become a master at one of them, you're going to have to give that one more time. Of all the things that I get to do, I love writing. I also am very attracted to coaching. But I've put in, I mean, thousands and thousands of hours on writing, and I'm kind of committing myself to that. But I can see myself developing another set of mastery around coaching over time, because it's a lot of the same thing, and a lot of the activities I do for writing are the exact same activities you would do to prepare to being a coach. So I don't know if that's a firm answer. I think you have to answer the question for yourself, but I think you have too many one things right now. That would be evident. You're not going to be great at all of those things.
It does sound like that. I need to keep asking myself that question until I really figure it out for myself.
Well, it's probably muddy for you because I think I was sharing, there's a lot of overlap in those skills. So what makes you good at one of them makes you good at a lot of them. But I would ask, where would it be most important for me to be extraordinary? And then say, how could I grow my biggest business big enough so that I didn't have to own all of these jobs? I can have an extraordinary person doing each of them. I mean, at my big aha when I was on Entre Leadership, you know, the Dave Ramsey podcast, Dave Ramsey doesn't host that, right? He built a world big enough that he could have, I think it was Chris Hogan that hosted it forever, who's his own personality now. And so you just, a lot of times you have to think bigger and say, what would be, you know, how would the best in the world handle this problem? And a lot of times the answer is already out there.
All right. Well, Jay, you ready for your book frog tool?
Yeah.
All right. So what's a book out there that's helped you become more productive?
I see this question and I just moan in agony, because if you saw my office, I've probably got 2,000 books in my office.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm gonna give you my big answer, right? The closest thing I can come to a book that I've given out more than any is probably gonna be The War of Art.
Oh, and that's love by that Stephen. One.
It's great, and I think it appeals to entrepreneurs and to artists and creatives, right? It's how you it's a great contemplation about how we do what we need to do most. And for whatever reason, it spoke to me. It speaks to a lot of people. Last year, the book I probably gave out more than anything else was Give and Take by Adam Grant, because one of the things I was exploring was how to be a better giver. And I thought that was a great model for how to give without being taken advantage of. So there's the big framework and the small framework.
Nice. I like it. What about a tool or a resource that you might recommend to our listeners?
I went tech tool on you here, right? Evernote is probably the thing in my world that I use. It's my Swiss Army knife. I use it to save research. I use it to take notes. I use it to capture receipts on business trips. I use it to capture business cards and then import them into my contact database. It's a truly exceptional tool that I'm able to get. It replaces multiple tools in my life. And so, I should be getting commissions for how many Evernote premium accounts that I've sold over my lifetime.
I just went full premium and I'm loving it.
It took me forever to figure out that I could capture receipts and use the tags to assign them to my different businesses, so I didn't have a wallet full of receipts with notes on the back. And I could actually then just send that PDF to my accountant, and it just made my life so much easier. And the same with business cards. Like, it's a very, very handy tool.
Yeah, we just started using that as well. I believe it's called Scannable, to use that app with Evernote to get your receipts in.
No, I just use the camera. If you hover your camera over them, you can save them.
Well, there you go. Maybe I'm extra oversupplying my apps. I need to get to my one app.
that might do it better, and it might save it as a receipt. I don't know, but that's how my system's been working. I think I'm a power user, and I'm always learning. So I'm glad you're on board too.
All right. What about a frog or a big project that you are working on and looking to complete?
You know, right now, my frog is always my daily cross to bear, right, is how can I continue to motivate myself to show up on a regular basis and put in the hours to write this book or the next book with Gary. And, you know, he and I sometimes write together. We sometimes write separately, and we try to hold each other accountable to being there and putting out the work. And so that's it. That's my frog. I've chosen to eat the same frog day in and day out for probably the rest of my life. And it doesn't get any easier, even though, let's say it does get easier, but it never becomes, you know, completely easy. But that's my thing. Like right now, we're updating our first book, The Millionaire Real Estate Agent. It sold almost 900,000 copies. It's 13 years old. And it's kind of become a classic, and it's really challenging for us. And that's what I'm putting a lot of thought and effort into every day.
All right. Well, before we leave, please feel free to give our listeners any parting piece of guidance, maybe where they can best find you online, and then we can say goodbye.
You know, all of our stuff around our book, our tools and resources, is at theonething.com with the number one. And you and I were both talking. Our team put together a really nice workbook at theonething.com/mypurpose. And it's a good workbook for kind of figuring out what your one thing is in the biggest possible sense. And for a lot of people, that's kind of the first domino for them. If they can kind of figure out what their biggest gift of the world might be, it kind of leads them backwards to what they should be doing this month or this year. So theonething.com is where I'd probably point people, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. And theonething.com/mypurpose is, I was looking at this before, and it's really nice. There's a 4 or 5 at least exercises that you can go in to help find your one thing. Apparently, I need to go through it right now, so I'll be printing it out after this show. And I'll also make sure it's in the show notes so people can just find it very quickly with one click.
Well, thanks a lot, Zachary. This is awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Jay. It's a real honor, and I can't wait to connect with you when we get to Austin.
Awesome.
Wow. I hope you got a lot out of that episode. I know I certainly did. I am recording this outro in Scottsdale, Arizona, after a night in Sedona. It was beautiful, but a little bit overrun with people, so we decided to spend a night in a hotel room. You might hear a bird chirping in the background, otherwise it might be a little more quiet than my normal camping outros. Jay and the resources that can be found at theonething.com/mypurpose helped me realize that coaching is going to be my one thing. More specifically, it is to find self-control, self-knowledge, and self-reverence and help other people do the same. Since then, I've been investing a disproportionate amount of time reading, training, working, and speaking with other productivity coaches like David Allen, Amber Della Garza, Jamie Tardy, Mike Vardy, and Darren Boss. I've also been opening up much more of my time to one-on-one coaching sessions. So everybody, including us, gets stuck, whether it's from a lack of clarity, a sense of overwhelm, or just not feeling all that motivated. We've all run into this before. In fact, you just heard me getting unstuck by Jay in this very episode, and it only took seconds. If this stuck feeling seems like a challenge you are currently facing, find out how you can get a free one-on-one coaching session by joining us on the Productivity webinar. To sign up, go to theproductivityshow.com/workshop or text TPS to the number 38470. The training, coaching, and this show are all geared to help you do, review, organize, prioritize, eliminate the unimportant, delegate and automate what you can, focus on your most important task, take care of yourself, find momentum, move toward your ideal, achieve anything but not everything, enjoy this life, do more, and be better. Thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to joining you next productive Monday.